Hello and welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. I'm Viv Davis from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. It's the 6th of September 2012 and I'm speaking to Xavier Freixas, Professor of Economics at the Universitat Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona, about his recent paper on bank resolution in Europe. I began the interview by suggesting that cross-border or systemic bank resolution was once the Cinderella of regulatory reform, but that it's now become center stage.
Yes, definitely. The perspective on banks' bankruptcy has changed completely. And for once, I think that the theory goes in the direction of the changes that have been proposed at the regulatory level, mainly in Europe.
In your recent Vox column titled Towards a New Framework for Bank Resolution, you argue that the recent introductions to the bank regulatory framework in Europe, particularly with regard to bank resolution, such as the European Crisis Management Directive, for example, are crucial in order to improve the efficiency of the banking system. Could you explain?
Definitely. For a long time, the theory of banking has justified banking regulation because of contagion, because of the high social cost of a bank failure. And the next idea was, well, if we have a bank that is failing, then this should be avoided. Therefore, we need, on the one hand, deposit insurance so as to limit the impact of bank failure, and on the other hand, capital requirements so as to limit the probability itself of a bank failure. But what was not done yet was to minimize the cost of contagion, the cost of this externality, at the very point where it is created, and that is at the bankruptcy, at the point of bankruptcy. The U.S. had these rules that were great from and were maybe the consequence of the saving and loan crisis, and these were the prompt corrective action rules that allow the regulatory authorities to intervene at the right time when capital was depleted and introduce measures to limit the strategies or the possible actions of the bank that would be detrimental to basically taxpayers, to the deposit insurance fund, and maybe to taxpayers if the deposit insurance fund is insufficient. Now, Europe is taking the same road, and I think this is really a great step forward.
In your paper, you also describe the tension between ex-ante incentives and ex-post efficiency in classic bankruptcy and in banking scenarios, and suggest that the best way to analyze a bank resolution situation is to think of it as a bargaining game between the bank's shareholders and the Treasury. Could you elaborate a little on this for us?
Definitely. So why do firms have debt? Well, there are two explanations from a theoretical perspective. One is simply because taxes are there and taxes on debt are tax deductible. Debt is tax deductible. Interest on debt is tax deductible. So that's one explanation. But the other one, more interesting, is that debt provides the right incentives for managers because if they don't behave in the right way, they go bankrupt. This is the ex-ante incentive effect, and from that perspective, what we want is debt to be non-renegotiable. Now, the alternative is say, well, there is a cost of bankruptcy, so once bankruptcy occurs, we would like to limit the cost, the inefficiency of bankruptcy, to limit the number of lawyers, if you want, right, to put it bluntly. And for that, we want ex-post bankruptcy to be renegotiated to introduce, say, swaps, debt exchange, debt-equity swaps or the like that will improve the situation of the firm. Now, this is slightly different for banks. Why? Because the social cost of a bank bankruptcy is considered much higher than the social cost of a standard firm bankruptcy. Right? Indeed, there would be layoffs and so on in a standard firm, in a non-financial firm bankruptcy, but there is not such a social cost, and in particular, there is no contagion. And therefore, having the right bankruptcy rules is critical. And it's all the more important that when we consider what happens, take the case of Fortis, for instance. What happens with Fortis? Well, on the one hand, we have the regulator that wanted to solve the problem in the quickest way, right? So time was in the essence for the regulator. But on the other hand, bargaining with the regulator, we have the shareholders. And the shareholders, of course, prefer to litigate. And therefore, the objective is completely different. They don't have any hurry. They want to maximize the value of their shares. They want to avoid dilution of their shares. And so the bargaining situation is such that the treasury is usually in a very weak position. It's in a weak position because the treasury usually and the regulatory authorities are in a hurry. They want to minimize the threat to financial stability. While shareholders simply want to litigate and get the maximum amount out of their shares. Now, if this is the bargaining game, the solution to the bargaining game is defined in part by what if there is no agreement. And if there is no agreement, there is bankruptcy. Now, as we didn't have a specific bank resolution regime in Europe, this meant that if we had bankruptcy, well, this could go on for 5 years or something like that. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but it's a common bankruptcy procedure that was in place for non-financial firms and for banks. And therefore, the threat of bankruptcy was quite often not credible, and the standard thing was to bail out banks. And before the crisis, the standard view of regulators was that too big to fail banks, now we would say SIFIs, or systemically important financial institutions, these systemically important institutions would be bailout. That was the standard view, while non-systemic ones would be liquidated. This turned out not to be entirely true, and Northern Rock was the first non-systemic bank to be nationalized as a form of bailout. And so what we have now is a different view, and that is that if we have the right legal and regulatory instruments, as it is the case with the proposal of June, with the European Commission proposal of June, then it's the bankruptcy threat is quite credible, right? Because there is no contagion associated, and it's simply saying, well, you know, shareholders will get zero, and that is that. Subordinated debt will get zero, maybe, and that is that. And so this is the schemes that are the so-called bail-in type of schemes that minimize the cost to taxpayers, while at the same time they limit contagion. Because if shareholders' value is wiped out, there is no contagion. Contagion comes from the payment system, of course.
Can bank resolution be a one-size-fits-all approach, or is each country a special case? In a recent Vox column, for example, Daniel Gross and Dirk Schoenmacher describe how in Greece it's the insolvency of the government that has sunk the banks, yet in Spain it's the banks that are sinking the government. What are your thoughts on the challenges of national differences in banking regulation?
The great news are that we now will have resolution mechanisms, and so we had in 2000, so all over Europe, in 2010 we have a Danish scheme for the winding up of banks that is great. Last Friday we have the Spanish government that put forward the legislation to cope with the European Memorandum of Understanding. and it goes exactly in this direction. So what this means is that now we have the instruments to solve the crisis. Now your question is somewhat complicated for the following reason. That on the one hand, we would like to have sufficient flexibility at the level of the country so that each country somehow may face a different crisis. Some countries have very large banks, other countries do not. And so we would like to have, we wouldn't like to have this one-size-fits-all approach. On the other hand, there is a political economy approach that will tell us, well, if you leave it to the government will maximize its objective function, that is, to stay in government for the longer period of time, right? And this is not exactly minimizing taxpayer cost of a bank resolution. It is not exactly improving the long-term efficiency of the banking system. And this, I'm thinking of Bankia in Spain. It's a very large bank. And quite possibly the Spanish government will decide that, you know, we will not liquidate it, and this will be very costly for taxpayer, but the government has already injected money in Bankia and has already committed somehow to keep Bankia going. So, because the government has already put some money in it, now deciding to liquidate it would mean that it was wrong in the first place, and this politically has a strong cost, which means that the political dimension is there. And from the political dimension perspective, it would be better to have sort of strict rules that the objective function is, one, to minimize the cost of taxpayers, the cost to taxpayers, and at the same time, to increase long-run efficiency of the banking system.
So finally, Xavier, what would you say are the most important elements of an effective bank resolution framework?
Well, clearly, from the theoretical perspective, what we want is that the managers know they will be penalized if they take too much risk. And this was not the case prior to the crisis. The banks were running huge maturity mismatch and were collectively engaging in moral hazard in the sense that they were illiquid, but each of them individually was okay because they were facing liquid markets. And then suddenly the interbank market collapsed, and there was this liquidity crisis. And so I think that having a real threat of bankruptcy, so that defined in terms of, well, you know, shareholders will not be diluted. They will get zero out. They will be completely wiped out. This is something the managers will take very seriously and therefore will consider the real risk of the investments they are taking rather than herding with the other banks in going into the subprime investment in the U.S. or going into the mortgage investment in Spain.
Xavier Freixas, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you very much.